Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, Revenge Spending. It sounds like something someone would do after a breakup, right? But it is quite common as people segue back into a more normal life post-pandemic. So what is it? And how do you know if it's a problem for you? Personal finance journalist Zentile Chiwanza is going to be here to talk about that. Basic income has been an idea that's been around for a while now, but what do younger Canadians think about it? We'll talk about basic income and Gen Z with economist and professor Evelyn Forget to talk about how it works and how to sell that for this generation. Then students getting down to work for money. An app called Local Student is trying to connect homeowners with students looking to make some cash. Co-founder Matt McCoy is here to talk about that. Plus, David Feller, CEO of Mogo, no longer a startup, Mogo. We're going to talk about what the company is trying to do to connect clients and climate. Green Bitcoin, planting trees. How much of this is mission and how much is marketing? This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and by Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Let's get started. Shoveling snow, mowing lawns. These are great, great, great jobs for young people to both get some work experience and also to make some cash. It was probably inevitable, but now there is an app that connects homeowners to students who are looking to earn money with people who have tasks they need some help with. Basically, I think it's you could call it the Uber for student services. It's called Local Student, and Matt McCoy is one of the platform's co-founders. He joins us from Oakville, Ontario. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce. Great to be here. I'm excited.
So I took over my brother's year-round property maintenance business, snow and lawns, when I was 13. 50% of year one revenue, book value on commercial equipment. I have mowed me some lawns. You've mowed you some lawns?
Yes, I have.
Okay, good. It's a very important mark of credibility. Why did you decide to start Local Student?
Yes, that's a great question. We basically experienced, I guess, what a lot of students experience being in the typical student job market, like in fast food and retail. A lot of the jobs available, I guess, to students when they're a little bit younger are pretty inflexible. So having those, I guess, 8 to 10 hour shifts right in the middle of school, when you have, you know, extracurriculars, a bunch of things going on. So jobs kind of felt like they were getting in the way. And also, I think I speak for all students in saying that minimum wage, especially student minimum wage, isn't really the best. So I guess we really felt like there was an opportunity having been, lucky enough to experience working directly in home services, you know, shoveling snow, mowing lawns for our neighbors at the start. And we realized that a lot of people just love supporting students and specifically local students in their community. So we thought it'd be really cool if there was a platform that easily connected homeowners with students for those odd jobs that, they like supporting students to get done around the house.
What are some of the, where's the constraint? Is the constraint that there are not enough jobs for students on your platform, or are there not enough students for the jobs that people want to get done? Where does supply and demand come together?
So that's definitely changed as we've evolved. So we've been around for a couple of years now. At the start, we definitely needed to get customers first. But we found that there's an overwhelming support for students, and a lot of people would rather support a student than do, you know, lawn mowing or snow shoveling themselves. Yeah. Everyone's busy these days. So we typically do see a lot of customers. And then in terms of students, we are always recruiting more students. We have a pretty good, I guess, a filter process to make sure that we're, bringing on capable students that do want to serve our customers. I would say our biggest bottleneck potentially would be on the student side, because students are busy. So we're honestly in a constant phase of bringing on more students.
Yeah. How do you manage quality? I mean, with Uber, we mentioned Uber. With Uber, I rate the driver. They rate me, but mostly I rate the driver. There's training. There's an app that tracks their time, the route that they took. How do you apply that to Local Student?
Yes. So we actually had, to give you some context, we had over 15,000 students apply back just last year. And we narrowed it down to just a few hundred that we actually onboarded onto our platform. So we have a pretty good filtration process at the very beginning, just filtering through applicants based on their resume and some interviews. And then what we do after we've selected our candidates we'd like to move forward with is we do a full orientation session where we onboard the students, talk about the service, talk about the system and all the processes we have in place. And then afterwards, after the service has been completed, our customers, just like Uber, can leave our students a review, a rating. And it's really great to see the feedback. We actually ask every single customer what their feedback was about the experience, if there's any issues or anything like that. We're able to quickly resolve those. So we have a really high satisfaction rate.
A difference with Uber is I couldn't care less who the driver is. I want to get from A to B and I'm never going to book the same driver. You're coming to do my lawn. I'm going to tell you what's important to me about the lawn and I want you to come back and do it again. How does local student work such that I could have a regular student? Because I know with Jiffy, which is a similar idea, no one's incented to have that relationship continue.
Right. So definitely a great question. We do find that our customers do build relationships with students on an individual basis. What our platform, the benefit, I guess, to the student on our platform is that they do have the ultimate flexibility should their schedule change, should they, you know, go on vacation and can't service that customer for the week, or if they're going back to school. You know, there's all kinds of variables in like the modern student schedule that we found. And so having an option where they can easily accept a job when it's convenient, when they're actually able to work, is a tremendous value proposition for them. And then for our customers, we do have customers request the same student over and over again. What we found is that our service specifically is so niche down. So specifically with lawn mowing, we are literally just cutting the grass. So we found that the service quality is pretty standardized to a point where our customers can expect to get a pretty consistent service regardless of which student comes. But we do make it very easy for our customers to request the same student. And we have had the same student service, the same set of customers throughout the summer.
How much of the fee do you take? You need to make money. How much? So if cutting a lawn is what, $30, $40, what does it cost these days?
It ranges. So it depends on the size of the lawn. It starts on the low 30s on the low end. And then if it's a very big property, it might go a little over 50.
So if I'm paying $30 to get a student to mow my lawn, what amount goes to local student?
So our cut ranges because we do have some add-ons and some customizations to the quote. On average, overall, it usually falls between around 30%, between 25 to 33% would be our cut. But on average, I think it falls around 30 right now.
Gotcha. So if I pay $30 to get my lawn cut, the student gets 20.
So I guess the most common would be $33 and the student would get 25 of that.
Gotcha. Now, there are pros to your model, the flexibility that you talk about, the money, the work experience, cutting the lawns. The big con, when I look back at my own experience that you're not going to get through local student, is you don't learn how to sell. Because that was one of the things I would go knocking on doors, signing up these people for year-round contracts. And it gave me an invaluable confidence engaging with grownups. Mm-hmm. How do you build that in? Or is that impossible?
I love that. So we actually started local student going door to door in our neighborhoods. It's so exhilarating and scary and a lot of fun just to connect with people. So it's definitely been on our mind from the very beginning. We actually fully allow our students, some of them are, have decided to be small business owners for the summer. So they'll use our platform to kind of get started and they'll take a certain number of jobs, but then they'll also maybe have their own business where they knock on doors and attract their own customers. So that's totally encouraged for us because we know that, as a student, we kind of want you to be proactive. And if you're doing well, you're going to be doing well with us. In the future, we've considered it. We do want to build out, a similar model to maybe a student franchise, such as College Pro, but making it a little bit more resilient and flexible to, the modern student or the modern student schedule. So there's a lot of upfront commitments. There's a lot of requirements with some of the student franchises. Whereas we kind of want to just pick and choose what the key value points. So as you mentioned, customer interactions, sales and marketing, things like that. We do want to give students that option and an incentive to do so. But right now, since we are so early, we've just sort of been focusing on having a repeatable model that we can offer to as many homeowners as possible, as many students as possible. And then we can iterate from there and add, you know, some of these great initiatives, as you mentioned.
Let's say you and I are talking in 5 years, 5 years from today, when you look at what you've accomplished in that 5 years that have elapsed, what are the things you are most proud of? Because I can imagine scale is really, really difficult. It's much easier when it's just technology. Scaling Facebook's not that hard, but you're talking about a human who's showing up at a house cranking on a lawnmower that might be futzy and might not work very well. And maybe they're hungover. They don't want to go in that day. This is complicated business.
Yes, definitely. Well, I'd say I'm most proud of us kind of getting that over that initial hump. There is a lot of, I guess, marketplace companies, you could call them, maybe gig economy companies, that do really struggle to match that supply and demand at the start. By nature, you have to go get customers before you get students to do the service, or you need to go get students before you have customers. So I think overcoming that initial hurdle was a huge accomplishment for our early team. And definitely we had so much help from mentors, from our early team members, from students who just stuck it out while we were using spreadsheets and a basic website. So I really think that that is probably the thing that we'll remember forever. I think as students, we get kind of undervalued in the market. We think that students are really capable of a lot of things. We're, of course, just offering, you know, things like lawn mowing, snow shoveling, things like that to get started. But we ultimately want to be a platform for any service that a student can do. So there's a wide range of that. Right now, we're kind of local in-person services, but we see no reason why we couldn't offer more skilled services such as graphic design, website design, or even just more services around the home that maybe would be a little bit more skilled. So we think students are capable. We think if we have the systems in place that make it so that it's very easy to join, very easy for the customer and the student, then we'll be able to eventually get there. Maybe 5 years would be ambitious, but that'd be great if we, you know, if we were offering a lot of different services by then.
You are making me nostalgic for the smell of fresh cut grass and the stain on my jeans. Matt, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Bruce. It was great being here.
Matt McCoy is one of the co-founders of Local Student, a coming together of entrepreneurial young people and those who have tasks they need done around the house, who have a particular affinity to get those young people working and get some cash into their pocket.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Basic income is an idea that has been around for years. The government effectively would give a regular payment to individuals to allow everyone to meet their very basic financial needs. And there can be some big benefits here in terms of reducing the drain on social services and continuing to drive demand for goods and services because more people can afford them. But basic income does come at a cost, as you can imagine. How would it work in Canada? And how might it impact younger generations like Gen Z? Evelyn Forget is an economist and professor at the University of Manitoba. I reached her in Winnipeg. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
What is the difference between basic income and what we know as social assistance today? So what used to be called welfare, employment insurance, those sorts of things.
I think the biggest difference between basic income and social assistance is that basic income comes as a guarantee. It doesn't require the kinds of bureaucratic means testing, the divestment of all assets before you're guaranteed any funding. It's also available to people who are working as well as people who are not working. So it acts both as a replacement for income assistance, provincial income assistance, and as a supplement for low-waged working people.
Can you talk a bit about the pros and cons of this model?
Well, I think one of the real benefits is that it's much, much less bureaucratic than the existing system. It's an easier entry for people who require assistance. But it also ensures that people have enough money and they have it in a guaranteed and predictable way so that they can meet their basic needs. Some of the real benefits are that we end up saving a lot of money on other social programs. People have enough money, for example, that we're not using the healthcare system to mop up the consequences of poverty. We're not using the prison system to deal with the consequences of poverty. People have enough money to live a reasonable life.
It's that it resonates for me in many ways, but as a fiscally conservative human, it's that kind of bigger picture and looking at the end, looking at the end we have in mind here of people living healthy, productive lives that there are cons. There are cons here. First among them is cost. Do we have a sense for how much a basic income program would cost in this country?
Actually, there have been several costing exercises that have taken place in Canada, some of them conducted by the Parliamentary Budget Office, hardly staffed by radicals. Mm. And I think that we do know that we have the capacity in this country to offer a reasonable basic income program to people.
What data exists elsewhere in the world that might support the case here? I mean, when Doug Ford came in Ontario, he canceled a pilot that was just in its beginning phases. So we didn't get that read on the difference that it could make. But in other countries, what's the data? What's the learning?
Well, there have been a number of basic income projects that have taken place all over the world, including an earlier one in Canada called MINCOM that took place in the 1970s. But we actually have a couple of basic income programs that exist in Canada already. You can think of the Canada Child Benefit, for example, as a basic income for folks who have children under the age of 18. Similarly, the OAS and GIS program for seniors is a slightly different form of the basic income. What we're really missing in this country is a program for people between the ages of 18 and 64, working age adults.
Well, I want to focus on the lower end of that range here, because this is something for young people that may have real resonance, especially given the economic circumstances that they find themselves in that are quite different for me as a Gen Xer or for a boomer before me.
I think one of the real differences that the current generation is facing is a very different kind of a labor market than you walked into and that I walked into many, many years ago. I think that when I watch my students, for example, heading out into the labor market, many of them are working on short-term contracts for much of their career before they end up with permanent full-time jobs. And those different kinds of jobs that people are holding make them very vulnerable to fluctuations in their income. And I think a basic income does a very nice job of filling in those gaps in what it is people earn. Another big difference, I think, is that most of us will be retraining many times over the course of our careers as we move forward. And a basic income makes that type of education and that type of training conceivable for people.
What would you say the pandemic taught us about basic income? I bet there are things that would be in the plus column for basic income. There also be some things that would be in the minus column. And I'll give you the example of the government programs that, if you talk to business leaders, provided a disincentive for people to go out and get work because there was so much need for workers in grocery delivery and custodial support and healthcare and like all these jobs that they were desperate to get filled, but they couldn't find people because they had the CERB or whatever they had. They weren't incented to work.
I think we have to be a little bit careful about that. I think there were lots of reasons that people weren't working during the pandemic, and some of them had to do with the need to be home with young children or school-age children when schools were closed, for example, or the inability of many employers to guarantee their workers a safe workplace. But the CERB did have certain design features, I think, that made it difficult for people to work. I think that a basic income would not necessarily be designed in quite the same way. There'd be a much more gradual phase out of benefits, for example, which would allow people to benefit from working to keep a larger portion of the income that they earned when they were working.
What's the simplest way in which folks would get qualified to be a recipient of basic income? It would need to be, as you say, much less onerous than some of the hoops that they have to jump through currently for existing programs. But what would it look like?
Well, I think some people who've been talking about a basic income imagine it operating through the income tax system, operating federally through the income tax mm-hmm. system. So it's simply a matter of reporting your income and then receiving payments. Of course, if you're replacing income assistance, you have to be able to respond quickly to people's needs. And I think we did learn some things about that during the pandemic as well, about how we might design and deliver a program mm-hmm. so that people receive the money they need.
And there's an inherent challenge with using the CRA or income tax Absolutely. Filing in that, what, 850,000 vulnerable Canadians simply don't file for many, many reasons, but in the absence of a tax filing, they don't qualify for the credits that they would receive, like the child tax benefit, as you referenced earlier. How do you overcome that?
Well, I think part of the reason people don't file is that they're not required to file if they don't earn income. If, on the other hand, they're about to receive large benefits through the income tax system, I think you'd see changes. As, for example, we saw with the Canada Child Benefit when it was expanded in 2016, the number of people filing in subsequent years has increased rather dramatically. So I think you do see part of that. But I think that there's also a requirement out there for existing services to pay a little bit of attention to ensure that people actually have the capacity to file income taxes and receive the help they need.
Do you believe, as an economist, as an academic, do you believe that basic income is something that Canadians should pursue and should support?
Absolutely. I think it's something that we're inevitably moving towards. I think that there are challenges in terms of how exactly we design and deliver it. But every year, every month, we get a little bit closer to being able to do that in a reasonable and concerted way. And I think everybody recognizes the limitations of the programs we currently have, the challenges and limitations of employment insurance, the challenges and limitations of provincial income assistance.
I'm going to oversimplify here, but there is data that says people around the world become more conservative in their thinking over time. It's not to a person, but the right-leaning parties have more support for people who are at the higher end of the age spectrum, and the left-leaning parties have higher support for those at the lower end of the age spectrum. How this relates here is if you're done your career, you have less of an incentive to support something like basic income if your perception is that it's going to cost you more in taxes. And it is the older people currently who decide who gets elected. How does that challenge from a policy standpoint get navigated, do you think?
You know, I think that there's both an appeal and a criticism of basic income right across the political spectrum. I think that there are many people who see the intrusiveness of existing social programs as a very negative thing, and many of those people would be voting conservative. So there are certain benefits to having programs that give people the freedom to spend their money on the things that they need to make their lives better. So that's not necessarily a negative thing. I think that there's a great deal of support for a basic income among older age groups. I think that people who've been around a little bit and recognize that any of us can be in a position where we need a little bit of extra help for a few years or even for a few months, and a basic income would make a real difference in our lives. Mm.
And a basic income that could allow someone to have certainty for a roof and certainty about food might make them less likely to need to call 911 or show up at an emergency room for something that isn't a car accident or a fracture. It's something that, if we got ahead of it, could have been navigated in a different way and at less cost.
I think so.
Yeah. Evelyn, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Evelyn Forget is an economist and professor at the University of Manitoba. Our focus was on basic income. I just wish I could snap my fingers and get some really robust tests in market, because I think we could learn a lot, and it could be a really, really big idea for the health and well-being of Canadians and also for government coffers. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, I'm going to be talking with a personal finance journalist named Zidile Chiwanza at her topic, revenge spending. I don't know when it is a problem for you. And later, a company that's trying to help customers turn spending into action against climate change. I'll talk to the CEO of Mogo, David Feller. If you have missed an episode of Moo La La, do not worry. Simple way to get caught up is to go over to moolala.ca. There is a section on the podcast, and you can listen to full episodes, or you can search by particular guest name or topic. Just search basic income. Well, you won't find that much because we haven't covered it enough. You can also go to any of the podcast platforms and catch up on Spotify, Stitcher, SiriusXM On Demand, Amazon Prime, whatever it is.
You're listening to Moo La La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Welcome back. Moo La La, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit. As I said, the counseling is free and judgment free. I think it is fair to say that there is some entitlement in the air. Everyone, high income, low income, tall or short, East Coast, West Coast, the North, everyone has been constrained in some way over the last couple of years. And as things go back to some sort of normal, some new definition of normal, sure, there is an urge to splurge. Some people would call it revenge spending, which I think it's such a great phrase. How do you know if that is becoming a problem for you, though? Personal finance journalist Sendile Chuanza has written about this, and she joins me now from Toronto. Hello there.
Hi.
How do you define revenge spending?
Well, revenge spending happens after any traumatic event. Obviously, the pandemic has been traumatic on a lot of people, a lot of households. And what's happened is because of all that restriction and not being able to spend our money, we may have this unprecedented urge to spend our money because of that restriction.
You write about your need to get your eyebrows done. That does not sound like revenge spending to me. That sounds like self-care. What's the difference?
Right. It is a difference. But I think if I compare, for example, the first sort of break we had from the pandemic last summer to this summer, there is a difference in how our urge to spend might feel. So a good example would be us not being able to travel for so long and the restrictions being lifted. Now I'm really feeling that urge to book a trip. I just want to catch a flight. And so that might not necessarily sound at first like a difference with self-care, but when I really look at it, can I afford to take a trip right now? That's something that you have to assess on an individual level.
What are some other examples in which someone would want to revenge spend? Is it, I don't know, breakups? Is it getting turfed from your job? What other examples would you give?
Right. So relationships are actually a big cause of revenge spending. For example, if your spouse spends $1,000 on maybe some things that they shouldn't be, you might feel the urge to do so. And so quite literally do some revenge spending. I know for myself, when I was trying to pay off my debt, I was on a really strict budget. And once I paid off my debt, I had this urge to spend because I wasn't able to do so before. So it can happen after any small incident. And it can also happen to people, for example, who might go on a diet from like wanting to lose a lot of weight. Then maybe they need to buy new clothes. So they might buy a whole new wardrobe rather than sort of taking it slowly. So it really does happen in many different ways, not just after a pandemic.
I'm sure as we talk about this, many, if not all of our listeners are like, oh yeah, they're nodding in their cars or in their homes or while they're listening to this on a run or whatever. What do the experts say about why this happens? Why do our brains work in this way?
Well, it's quite simple. When you restrict yourself, there does happen to be sort of a binge approach afterwards. And with the pandemic, we all had a lot of stress. It took a toll on our finances, our emotions, our spirituality, our physical selves. So you might just feel like, I've had enough. Enough is enough. I want to spend my money. I've been working hard. Or I want to experience new things. I want to actually live because I've been in this restrictive situation for so long. So people are frustrated and it's very understandable. Mm.
How does an individual make the call to say, oh yeah, actually this revenge spending is a problem. Like this isn't just a one-off thing or it wasn't, you know, $100. This is a real issue for me now.
Right. Like any other overspending situation, is there too much month at the end of your money? Like if you find yourself always pulling out a credit card or depleting your savings or taking on more debt than you can afford, then there really could be a problem. Are you compromising on other financial goals, such as your retirement savings, maybe, you know, reducing the amount that you're contributing there so you can focus on your current self? You know, is your financial anxiety increasing? Like, are you constantly worried about money? Is it disturbing your overall well-being? That's when it's a huge problem.
Did you just use the phrase, there's too much month at the end of your money? Have you used that phrase before? I think that's genius.
That's, I say that to myself all the time, like, especially before. Like,
it's only in February, it's okay, because February is a shorter month. So February is fine, but oh my gosh, any month with a 31st day, that's just too much.
Yeah, it's like I'm trying to survive on $20 right now to get me through the rest of this month. So wish me luck.
How can you prevent yourself from falling into this, call it a revenge spending spiral?
Right. So I don't ever want to recommend people take a restrictive approach to finances. Like we said, it really usually results in binging. And so when we have this all or nothing approach to spending, it can just have the opposite effect. And so I think one of the first things that you can do is be kind to yourself. We've all been through a lot. How can you manage your current self? Like, how can you actually have fun and maybe do a little bit of revenge spending that doesn't harm your finances? You know, consider a more mindful approach to the way that you're budgeting. It doesn't have to be that you are going out and spending all your money on things that you don't want to do and feeling guilty about it. Like, I randomly went to a concert last week. I really wanted to do it, but I assessed my budget and I really thought about what the consequences would be for myself. And I did it and I don't feel any way about it today. It was a guilt-free splurge. And that's when you kind of know in your gut that it's okay to spend the money.
Is there a way to build those concerts and those eyebrows and those, you know, for me, it would be travel. Like that's my number one thing to build them in to your budget. So they're just a part of how you live.
Absolutely. I love to account for fun things in your budget. Personally, after fixed expenses, investments, savings, I allocate money to spend on whatever I want. And there's no fixed percentage on that. It depends on your budget, your goals, your needs, but definitely make sure that you literally write in your budget, my whatever I want fund, my fun splurge account, whatever it looks like for you. Make a wish list and use a sinking fund, which is different to your savings for emergencies and other regular expenses. This is just specifically for fun things in your budget. And break it up. It, you know, it doesn't have to be all or nothing. You can plan little splurges here and there to sort of feed that impulse, because being impulsive or having those moments is a normal human reaction. We're not robots. It's going to happen. You definitely cannot tell me you haven't randomly bought something that you shouldn't have.
Even I have randomly bought something that perhaps I shouldn't have. Zendile, thank you so much for your time and your wisdom on this. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you so much.
Zendile Chuanza is a personal finance journalist. She joined us to talk about revenge spending and you know, some alternatives to reduce the risk that that's going to haunt you in the weeks and months to come.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, I'll speak to the CEO of Mogo, David Feller, about how the company is working on bringing together client behavior and reducing your carbon footprint. I am the money columnist for a TV show called Cityline. It is daily, it is lifestyle, it is food, fashion, and all that fun stuff, but it is also finance. You can go to cityline.tv, plug in celery, S-E-L-L-E-R-Y, and you'll find some of the stuff that we have done recently, including mortgages, which is a pretty big deal, especially this time of year.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Beer. We're going to talk about beer. There's Bud and there's Bud Light. You trade off some alcohol, so you lose the alcohol, but you also lose some calories. It's still beer, and that works in a lot of different categories in the grocery store. Turns out it works in financial planning, too. Light financial planning. We're going to talk about this as an idea. I've never had this conversation before. Preet Banerjee is our guest. He's a personal finance expert. He is the founder of Money Gaps. Preet, this is quite a little marketing hook you've come up with.
Well, you know what? I just got the idea for a new marketing hook. Tastes great, less filling.
Yes, that's it. Tastes great, less filling. That is the perfect approach here. How is light financial planning different from traditional high calorie, more expensive financial planning?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it really boils down to the fact that not everyone is as enthusiastic about comprehensive deep financial planning as people in the industry. And having been an advisor before, I remember thinking back to meeting with prospective clients and walking them through my sales pitch, which is, you know, look at this financial plan you're going to end up with, 30 or 50 pages that's going to encapsulate every year of your life for, you know, until you die. And then I realized they weren't as excited as I thought they were. And and that's because when we did a little bit of research, we asked people, how often do you actually read your thick financial plan? And the average was less than one.
Right.
Because not everyone reads it and no one reads it twice.
Yeah.
And so if you think about why that is, if you're 30, 40, 50, and someone is saying, listen, we are going to figure out exactly how much you're going to make, all your different income sources, how much tax you're going to pay from the time you're 65 to 90. I'm still thinking, I don't know what my life looks like in 5 years, let alone 30 years. So do we really need to go to that level just yet? And so light planning is kind of like a gateway drug.
Oh, that's good.
It pulls you into holistic financial planning. And so that later on, you're going to be in a much better position to take advantage of comprehensive planning when it's right for you.
So what are the key questions that are like fundamental to light financial planning? The short list that you really have to make some assumptions around or answer?
Yeah, it really comes down to people wanting to know, hey, compared to people like me, how am I doing? And are there any big mistakes that are in my blind spot? So a lot of people equate financial advice with investment advice. And of course, there's so much more to financial planning than just that. And one of the problems with, you know, the comprehensive financial planning and financial advice as it exists today is it's kind of binary. It's basically saying, listen, you're either flying first class to Paris or you're going to build your own raft and find a way to get there. There is no in between. Mm-hmm. And really what light planning is doing is giving people choice. It's like going to, you know, take a look at physical fitness. Imagine if the only option was you're going to get a personal trainer who's going to supervise every single rep for every time you set foot in the gym or nothing. That wouldn't make a lot of sense. There are people who use online classes. There are people who buy equipment for themselves at home. They join a gym but don't have a personal trainer. So really what light financial planning is doing is giving people a lot more choice because it isn't just binary. So you could, you know, maybe just talk to someone about, well, do I have the right sort of protection? Because I just got married, I've got kids, and I heard that maybe I'm supposed to protect my dependents in case something happens. And so that is a very, you know, topical need that they need to address right now. And that is, you know, kind of compartmentalizing some of the financial problems that people have.
How do you think about rules of thumb? Because one of the things that would make it so much simpler is if there were credible rules of thumb that would say, listen, you need to save 10% of your gross income per year. That will allow you to do X by Y date. How do you think about rules of thumb?
Yeah, it's a trade-off. And this is, I think, core to the point. The trade-off is if you're going to rely on, you know, light planning or, you know, even more elementary than that, you know, rules of thumb, you're not going to get the deep engagement, but maybe you don't necessarily need that. You know, if you've just graduated from school and you've got a lot of debt, maybe you don't need to focus so much on optimizing the perfect portfolio. Maybe you just need to figure out a plan for the short term of how do I tackle my debt and maybe start investing, because how much you put away is phenomenally more important than getting the perfect portfolio when you're 25. Mm-hmm. You've got time to figure that out. But the more time you have accumulating and putting money into that portfolio, that is going to make a huge amount of change to your life, you know, 20, 30 years down the road.
I mentioned off the top Money Gaps, which is, I don't know how you describe it, a software platform for financial advisors. What are the key things that Money Gaps allows an advisor to see in short order?
Yeah, so it looks at 8 different areas of someone's life: retirement income coverage, life insurance coverage, disability insurance coverage. Do they have the proper emergency fund? Do they have an estate plan in place? Do they have a budget? So it really covers the gamut, and it's planning centric as opposed to product centric, so that we can start getting better advice to people who don't have a lot of money. Because one of the problems in the industry is if you have a lot of money, you've got tons
of
choice.
You are set. You got a maid in the shade. They'll fly you to Paris.
Exactly. But if you don't have a lot of money, it feels like you don't have as many options. And so that's where light planning can come into place to help people get to a point where they have that potential, so that when they are ready for comprehensive planning, they've just got more to work with.
Interesting. Preet, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure as always, Bruce.
Preet Banerjee, personal finance expert, founder of Money Gaps. And he was here to talk about light financial planning. Now I am totally craving a beer, though I think it would be full strength. If you have missed an episode of this show, you can head to any of the podcast providers, Stitcher, Spotify, Amazon, wherever you find your podcast, download the full show. You can download specific segments. You could even write a review for us. Wouldn't that be nice? Moolala is sponsored by Home Equity Bank, the provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Here's the big idea. It empowers Canadian homeowners age 55 plus to live retirement on their terms by providing them with a safe and easy way to access the equity built up in their home. And given the prices of houses these days, that equity can be considerable. The funds can be used for whatever the client wants or whatever the client needs. And that could be travel, it could be helping grandchildren, or it could be supplementing their day-to-day expenses. You can access up to 55% of your home's value with no monthly mortgage payments required. Go to chip.ca to learn how you can stay in the home you love without having to move or downsize. That's Home Equity Bank.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Many, many consumers are trying to find ways to reduce their carbon footprint. And companies are marketing to that interest, right? In every single sector of the economy. In financial services, Mogo is one of them. It's trying to help its customers, for example, turn their spending into trees, Dave Feller is the CEO of Mogo. He joins us now from Vancouver to talk about this and something called Green Bitcoin. Hello there, Dave.
How are you? Thanks for having me.
I am well. I want to ask what this link is here. How does it work? It sounds like a fun little promotion idea, you know, buy a couch, build a plant, a tree. But how does it work?
Well, I mean, the genesis of the idea is really around our mission of not only financial health, but impact, right? Social impact. And, you know, at the end of the day, to build a solution for the next generation to not only get in control of their finances, but to actually build a better world is really what it's all about. And obviously social issues, you mean Gen Z, they want to change the world. They're looking to have an impact. And when you really boil it all down, money for most people is where they have the power, right? Where they have the impact. So whether it's the businesses that we support in terms of our purchasing, the companies we invest in, obviously ESG investing, as we know, is increasingly important. But an area that really has been forgotten is the importance of spending too. Because again, obviously more people spend a lot more money than they invest. So if you really want to have an impact making the world a better place, it's all about tying it into your spending. And so, you know, not only is it about being more mindful again of the companies you're choosing to support, are they doing the right things? Are they the kind of companies that are building a better world? But also addressing perhaps arguably one of the greatest social issues of our time, which is climate change. And you know, our carbon footprint comes from our spending, from our consumption. So there's a natural tie-in. So without adding in carbon reducing initiatives such as tree plantings, no individual has the ability to get to a net zero carbon footprint, which is actually what you need to do in order to solve climate change. And so our card makes it easy to do that, and it's free. So every time you use it, you plant a tree. And you know, you look at the average stats in Canada, the average Canadian uses their debit and credit card 50 times a month.
So is it by transaction or is it
by transaction? It's just by transaction. So if you used it 10 times a month, you'd plant 10 trees. The trees that we're planting in this particular case absorb 500 pounds over their lifetime. So that would be a 5,000 pound CO2 impact absorbing per month. The average Canadian carbon footprint is around 42,000 pounds. So if somebody used this for their main spending, they would offset typically, you know, 6 to 10 times the carbon footprint of the average Canadian.
Where are these trees getting planted, and are they what, oak?
Yeah, so ash? There's a bunch of different initiatives and you know that we are supporting. You know, we initially started out with a certified project in the Amazon rainforest. So it was actually specifically in the Amazon rainforest. We have now expanded that. Now we have initiatives globally. We're partnered with the Vancouver company Veritree. One of the trees that they're planting is a mangrove tree. So it also helps to support a local ecosystem in terms of creating jobs, et cetera. And we're recently partnered with a Canadian company called Flash Forest, and they are the first company to actually plant trees using drones.
Oh, I've seen the videos of this. It's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. And targeting areas devastated by wildfires, right? Areas that people couldn't get into previous to this.
So put this into dollars and cents. You're making a link between spending and trees. I totally get it. There is a dollar value to you as Mogo to contribute to that tree.
Correct.
Yep. So how much does that equal?
Again, the way we look at it is, you know, most consumers today for spending really are using predominantly credit cards, right? Credit cards obviously have the bulk of the spending in Canada, although debit cards are very popular. A lot of credit cards obviously have reward programs. We're really trying to come up with what is the appropriate reward program for a card. You could do cash back, you do a whole bunch of things. And increasingly, we think it's about making a bigger impact, right? And so it is essentially equivalent to, you know, if you went and did this on your own, if you went and offset your carbon footprint, it would typically cost you, you know, through a private solution, depending on your carbon footprint, anywhere from $20 to $100 a month. Right.
And so what does that equal? So you, we use the example of I use my debit card 10 times, you plant 10 right. trees. Does that right. cost Mogo 10 cents or $10?
Yeah. So I don't want to disclose what our pricing is, but what I can say is it is obviously we look at it as a form of cash back, right? So, you know, generally cash back programs can be up to one, and we used to do a program up to 2%. So instead of that, we're putting it towards this.
Okay. That's a helpful frame of reference. So, and, and when you frame it as a reward, as a consumer, I go, okay, I can get a card that earns me cash back. I can get a card that earns me traditional air miles. I can get a card that earns me free coffees, whatever.
Right.
Like there's lots of different ways. Okay. The other thing that is on your radar is something that you call green Bitcoin. What does that mean?
Yeah. So we're trying to basically build in the impact piece into all of our products. Bitcoin is another one that we launched where we were the first company globally to essentially offer the ability for consumers to buy climate positive Bitcoin. And that is actually going beyond offsetting the carbon footprint of Bitcoin and actually, you know, offsetting even more than the carbon footprint. Now, one of the big criticisms around Bitcoin is obviously its negative impact on the environment, but there's a lot of positive social impacts. And it really is about a belief that crypto is here to stay. Bitcoin is here to stay. We have to find, you know, more sustainable ways to enable users to participate in it. And although we are not mining the Bitcoin, so actually, and that's where typically the CO2 is produced, the estimated, just to give you a sense, the estimated carbon footprint of producing one Bitcoin is approximately 420,000 pounds. Hmm. And so Mogo, when if somebody buys a Bitcoin on our platform, will effectively offset 500,000 pounds of CO2 to make that Bitcoin climate positive.
And you're, are you offsetting it with trees again?
Yes, in this case, we are.
Okay. There is a certain degree of skepticism in the marketplace around all this stuff. Some people would call it greenwashing. Mm-hmm. So devil's advocate, is this mission driven or is this marketing?
I mean, at the end of the day, obviously marketing is, you know, at the end of the day, I would say any great product marketing is built into it. And this is obviously fundamentally about a belief that the future, from my perspective, the future of financial products will, I believe all of these will actually tie into this. This is just where things are going. This is, the connection is real, whether it's investing, whether it's spending, whether it's Bitcoin. And it's obviously something that, you know, when you're focusing on Gen Z and you think about it, I've got two kids. One just turned 19, the other one's 22. Mm-hmm. My goal was to always build a solution that I wish I had when they were their age in terms of being in control of my finances. But for them too, climate anxiety is a real issue, right? And so when you're planning on getting on a path to financial freedom and you're 20 and you're looking at a 40, 50, even 60 year time horizon, given the issues around climate change, you know, you have to say, well, you know, a lot of people is like, is there even going to be a planet here to even worry about financial freedom? So we've got to incorporate it. And we believe it's a critical component and it's absolutely mission driven. It's part of our mission.
When you go 5 years out, 10 years out, what do you see will be the manifestation of this commitment down the line? So right now it's trees, principally trees, and it's very tangible, right? I can picture that drone landing in the earth. And there's
exactly.
What are other ways in which that this could manifest?
Again, it's about social impact. And some people, you know, they see the environment and climate change as environmental and social as separate. But the reality is, you know, climate change is arguably one of the greatest social issues we have. So if you look, for example, at the UN and their top social causes, poverty is number one. Well, the people that are hit hardest by climate change are those that are most marginalized and at risk. In fact, an estimated 5 million people a year die because of climate change related issues. So when we look out, you know, 5 years from now, I truly believe, just like it's come into investing, increasingly the younger generation wants to make sure that not only are they going to get a good return, but that it's going to support companies doing the right thing, because it's all about, are we actually building the world we all want to live in, one with more equality, social justice, as well as a healthy planet? And I think it's foundational. And I think only companies that actually help support that are going to win. By definition, you know, those companies that don't and aren't part of the solution, they're not going to have the customers.
Do you think you can limit where your debit card will work? And when there are transactions that are clearly counter to climate, the debit card just gets rejected?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, wait a sec. You want to buy? No, that is wasteful. The Mogo card does not work for you.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. And those are some of the things that we've looked at. I would say generally what we're trying to do is, how do you make addressing climate change really accessible for everybody versus saying, hey, you've got to stop eating meat, you can't drive a gas car, you can't travel. Obviously, traveling by plane is one of the biggest issues, right? You can't buy clothing. I mean, think about all the things that you can't do. So how do you make this something in which, even if you're out there living your normal life, if you use this card, I would argue that there's no greater impact somebody can make with the least amount of effort. So if somebody doesn't change anything, but they actually start using this card for their spending, they're going to be climate positive. They're effectively going to do more for helping save and to stop climate change. It's math. We have to get the total CO2 down to net zero. I mean, just as an example, if 25% of transactions of debit and credit cards in Canada were done in the most, Canada would be climate positive, right? Assuming no other change. But what it also does is it just naturally helps to make people more mindful. You know, they're seeing the link between the planet, they're seeing their planting trees, and it starts to, you know, more of that nudge towards more mindfulness, saying, hey, I want to make more responsible choices, but it doesn't stop you from doing things like, hey, I can't afford an electric car today. I'm filling up with gas. This is a more responsible way to do it.
Very interesting. Dave, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Dave Feller is the CEO of Mogo, and we were talking about the connection that it is making between client behavior spending and different ways in which we can all make a difference on reducing climate change. That's it for our show today. Thank you to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. To stay up to date on all things Moolala, very simple to do that, you can subscribe to our newsletter. It is at moolala.ca, moolala.ca. You subscribe there, and we send you a newsletter once a month with info on what we have done for CityLine and on this show on Sirius XM and CBC Radio and all that stuff. If you have feedback for us, thoughts, ideas, questions, concerns, complaints, you can email me at ask@moolala.ca. On social media, I am at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for joining us, and have a great day.